You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in El Pozo Alimentación.
Well, we were played in there by the noise that dominated today, and that was of rain and thunder. I'm Richard Moore, I'm with Fran Reyes.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And I wouldn't have known we were in Spain today, Fran. What? I usually say, where are we? But what happened to the weather?
Well, I guess we came to Murcia and the weather decided to surprise us, as Rojas tried to surprise their train team when they finished on the stage.
We'll get on to that. We've got a packed show tonight. We didn't have one yesterday, of course, on the rest day, and there were a few press conferences and so on. A few of us went to Team Sky.
A few of us went to the beach.
And
didn't you? I mean,
Maybe briefly, Daniel. Briefly, the rest days are very important, you know. Anyway,
what did you do, Fran?
Well, I stayed up late and worked until 6 a.m. yesterday night. We're developing a marketing plan, seriously, for a client. Well, were you up until late?
So much for stereotypes about the Spanish.
Sorry if it's a bit echoey tonight, but we've been forced inside because of the aforementioned rain. Daniel pointed out there was according to the weather forecast, there was a 100% chance of rain, which are odds that we didn't really want to argue with. So anyway, we've got an interview with Chris Froome later on. We've got a scoop tonight. Fran has got us a very, very interesting scoop. We're going to hear from Eusebio Unzué in connection to that. So that'll be the start of part two. We've got quite an interesting stage to talk about first. I'll do the tale of the etapa, will I? Fast stage. I mean, they call it a transition stage today, but it was a pretty hard day. And it was fast. Maybe the riders wanted to get it over with in the rain. It took until 90 kilometers for the breakaway to form 20 riders, including local rider Luis Leon Sanchez. A lot of the usual suspects in that break, guys that we've seen quite a lot of. Alessandro De Marchi. Little story about Alessandro De Marchi the other day, after the stage that Mohoric won. He came across the line looking very unhappy, and a fan was running alongside him looking for a bottle. And De Marchi reached down, got his bottle, and threw it with force at the guy. And it wasn't a particularly nice thing to see.
He's quite an angry looking chap, generally, isn't he?
He does have an angry face.
He looks a bit like David Moyes. Anyway.
Well, Matteo Trentin was there. He's won a stage already. Of course, his teammate Nicky Terpstra was there. Rafael Reiss was there. He's been up there, of course, before. Juan Jose Lobato was there. More of a sprinter, really. Marc Soler was there. He's been quite a few breaks. Alexander Geniez was there. Julien Bernard was there. His father won a stage of the Vuelta 30 years ago. Oh, no, he didn't. He won a stage of the Giro 30 years ago. Apologies. Always get them mixed up. Anyway, that was the breakaway. 20 riders, and with 40 kilometers left, they tackled the third category climb, and they got a big lead, so that it was always going to be fought out between them. Sky controlling things behind on the third category climb, the Alto del Morón de Totana, which I think is where you're staying tonight, Fran. Van Rensburg went pretty hard up there, started to split up behind him, and that set things up for the final very tough climb with an even tougher or more technical descent. And Van Rensburg was still out front, three riders chasing. Initially, Terpstra was one of them. Then Trentin seemed to just replace him among the chasers. The group just behind included Rojas. And behind, in the main group, Barry Merida took over from Sky at the front, suggesting that they were setting up Vincenzo Nibali for something. Going over the top of the climb, we had Rojas, Trentin, and Jaime Rossen from Caja Rural, with Van Rensburg there or thereabouts, Marc Soler and Geniez behind. Geniez put in a very odd display of descending. It was speedway style, kept putting his foot down. I haven't seen that before. Loads of switchbacks, very spectacular descent when we talk about that. Rossen was dropped, Nibali attacked behind as we expected. Never got too much. Eventually it was Nicholas Roach who clipped off the front and claimed 30 seconds to move to second equal overall with Esteban Chavez, 36 seconds down on Chris Froome. And up front, it was Trentin, the points leader, who won his second stage, easily out-sprinting Rojas, who'd give him a fantastic lead out. Simon Yates lost more time today. Movistar remained the best team. Davide Villela is still king of the mountains. Froome is still leading the combined classification as well as the overall classification. And it was an exciting stage, wasn't it? I mean, we'll talk about maybe the overall stuff, the Roach move in particular, and Nibali in part two. But another win for Matteo Trentin. And I was staggered at Rojas. He hasn't won many races, has he, Rojas?
Yeah.
And you can see why.
Never won a stage at the Vuelta, which surprised me.
Yeah, but you know, the running gag with Jose Joaquin Rojas is that he always finishes fourth. You know, he's a guy that has been quite fast during his whole career, but not as fast as the best sprinters out there. And being consistent, he has been able to challenge even for the point jersey on the Tour de France 1 year with Mark Cavendish head on. But he has never been the fastest guy. And actually, the other day, on the descent, after the descent down to Cuenca, where he was always also in the mix for the win, he told the media that after the horrible crash he suffered 1 year ago, maybe, he has lost quite a big amount of speed.
And maybe confidence as well, because that was the stage that Mohoric won with that death-defying descent. I think Rojas was third on that day. But, you know, he was the fastest of the little group behind. But I like Fran. You, what was it you said when you came here? You said that Rojas had surprised Trent.
Yeah, he told the media that he knew the finish by heart. He knew the roads perfectly, so he decided to wait and try to surprise Trentin in the finale. And for sure, he did surprise him, because the leadout was impressive, you know, and it was a surprising leadout.
The surprise was that he gifted Trentin the stage. I mean, he made it easy for Trentin. He had the perfect excuse to sit on with Marc Soler, one of the guys chasing behind. Yeah. You know, he was a bit far back, and there were another two there as well. But it was that would have been an excuse to sit on.
Yeah, and of course, Fran Rojas is from Murcia, and he actually won his first pro race in the Vuelta a Murcia, and obviously had a lot of support today. But I'd be intrigued to hear from you. What is the perception of Murcia in Spain? Just as if we go outside of cycling, go outside the Vuelta for a while, because if you're a cycling fan, the one thing you know about Murcia is that Alejandro Valverde is from there. But there isn't a big, I hate to mention football again, there isn't a big football team. It's not a region of Spain that you hear a huge amount about. In the UK, in England, people know about La Manga, the golf course. Yeah. But otherwise,
some do.
Not a whole lot. So how is Murcia, and people from Murcia, how are they perceived in Spain?
Well, okay, so there are three jokes that we usually make out of Murcia. First is that we tend to consider or to call people in Murcia rednecks. Second is that we always joke that they don't know how to speak, and indeed it's sometimes hard to understand what people from Murcia are saying. Not for me, because some of my family actually lives in Murcia, but for general people, in TV, when a person from Murcia is interviewed, sometimes they have to subtitle them in order to the general Spanish public to understand what they're saying.
And in cycling terms, the climb that we went over today, and I was reminded the Collado Bermejo, is now, whenever it's used, or is it used every year in the Vuelta a Murcia, but it's the Cima, in Italian, Cima Pantani, they call it, because Marco Pantani put on a bit of a show there on a couple of occasions in the late 1990s, 97 and 99. And there was always a stage of the Vuelta a Murcia that went over that climb, and he, I think, won it a couple of times. And, very much tied to his sort of legend. And so it was kind of appropriate that an Italian won today.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. A reminder, 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. Had a message from friend of the podcast and Science and Sport chief executive, Stephen Moon, this week. He is in the very south of Italy with 150,000 other people watching Tarantella bands. 100% our fault, he says. He liked the Giro theme on the podcast so much, went to see Amara Terra, the band that plays our Giro theme in London, and now he's ended up at the world's biggest Taranta festival. And he's written a very entertaining blog about it as well. So that's a great
story.
Hell
of a story.
That's a great story. Thanks for letting us know, Stephen. Didn't check with you that you would mind us mentioning it on the podcast, but I didn't think you would anyway. Let's crack on with tonight's show, no, Fran.
But yeah. Do you want to hear a scoop?
The scoop. We want the scoop. You've been building up to this for a few days. You've been very
Richard
very
is usually the one. Richard Baskin Robbins Moore is usually the one that comes up with the scoop.
Fran's been far more rigorous than I usually am, and he's been actually checking sources, checking, you know, third, fourth sources for this story. So tell us what it is, Fran. It's exciting news.
Well, okay, so I'm going to take the rabbit out of the hat straight away and say that the Movistar team is rumored to set up a new Women's World Tour team next year. I've been hearing about this for a week or so, and this morning I went and talked to Eusebio Ansue about that.
Llegar a este invierno, porque viendo la tesitura y escuchando los rumores que oigo, parece que sí.
We've been working on this for a couple of years. This is a step forward we're bound to make at some point, as women's sports keep growing. For the moment, we're getting to know women's cycling. It's too soon to confirm anything as of yet. We will see if the project takes this winter or the next one.
That was Eusebio Unzue there, voiced by Lionel Burney. Didn't adopt a Welsh accent this time, but Unzue is the big boss of the Movistar team.
With a marvellous quiff. Marvellous quiff. Sweeps to one side before he starts every interview.
He's been around forever. And I mean, Fran, it's very interesting news, this, that Movistar want to set up a women's team either next season or the following season.
The best Spanish riders. I haven't been able to actually find which names will be rating for the team, but still, exciting news, and it probably will be officially announced in the next couple of weeks, maybe the same day that the Vuelta finishes
Madrid
with the
Challenge,
Vuelta.
Of course, which is the final event of the Women's World Tour this year. I mean, Francis de Jeux did it this year. They started a women's team this year. Orica, Sunweb have women's teams. Most male teams don't have women's teams. Mm-hmm. And it's great that a team like Movistar has taken this step, or is going to take this step, I think, and it puts some other teams to shame. I mean, we were at Team Sky yesterday at their new hub, which is
Skytropolis.
This mobile thing that moves around and expands out the way and up the way and creates this enormous space. I mean, downstairs is for the riders, upstairs is for the staff, and it's like a sixth form common room or something up there. But you know, big
no pool table though, is there?
No pool table.
No dartboard.
But lots of coffee machines and things like that, and comfy
hand
sofas.
Gel. Lots of hand gel. Have you ever seen that much hand gel?
But the riders are, you know, the riders are banned from shaking journalists' hands, and they're not the only team doing this. Riders have been instructed to fist bump rather than shake the journalists' hands.
Do you do fist bumps?
I don't. No.
I don't know. No. I also don't do that weird handshake. We're really diverging. I don't do that weird sportsman handshake. The weird like LT. The weird like tennis player handshake.
Don't
you know
that.
The kind of thumbs interlocking. Don't like.
What's
that.
Wrong with a conventional good firm handshake? Anyway,
Or a wink. I often wink.
I've noticed that it's really dodgy. But the one thing that occurred to me, I don't know what it's costing Sky. They've got it for 5 weeks. They've got it on loan. It's clearly something they want to develop, and if they may well build their own next year. But the cost of that might not be far off running a women's team, which is an interesting thought.
Yeah, you might be right, Rich. And obviously, the gulf between rich and poor has come into focus again in the last few days in professional cycling with Cannondale struggling so badly and so publicly to ensure their survival next year, and Sky announcing the signing, which, you know, it's not going to be particularly financially onerous, but they've announced the signing of the three biggest prospects in under 23 racing. So Egan Bernal, who's just won the Tour de l'Avenir, Pavel Sivakov, and the Norwegian sprinter whose name I've forgotten,
Frans Christopher Halvorsen,
under 23 world champion.
You go. And, you know, they're mopping up all the talent. I understand they were also, you know, they explored the possibility of re-signing Rigoberto Urán. I don't think that would have posed a particular problem for them financially, but perhaps decided that, you know, that they didn't want to face accusations of being megalomaniacs, so passed on that. But, you know, there's a Team Sky with huge resources, only one title sponsor. They don't, you know, they're not scratching around for second or third names, which is commonplace among the other teams in the World Tour. But, you know, I suppose they're exploiting the circumstances that they've created, really. They've exploited a boom in the United Kingdom that a lot of individuals in that setup have helped to create.
True. Back to the race. We will hear from Chris Froome in the next part, as I mentioned. But we should turn our attention to what happened in the overall situation today, the overall picture, shuffled around a little bit with Roach moving up to second. I mean, we haven't spoken about or to Roach very much, and we must do that over the next few days, I think, because he's putting in some ride, isn't he? He's up to second equal overall with Esteban Chavez, and you keep waiting for him to fall away, and he hasn't yet. He's riding extremely well, and I think that's probably taken a lot of people by surprise, maybe even Roach himself. But it was Nibali that kind of set it up. I mean, it was a spectacular, beautiful, stunning descent, switchbacks down the side of the mountain. The TV pictures, which has been a theme of this Vuelta, weren't great. We didn't see an awful lot of what was happening.
No, they were a bit Blair Witch Project, weren't they? they were a bit jerky. We didn't see an awful lot. There was fog. We saw trees. We saw things moving in the trees.
A lot of trees. A shark. We saw a shark moving in the trees.
Yeah.
And he telegraphed a little bit with getting the team to
the front.
Yeah,
he generally...
I wondered about that.
He generally does telegraph his attacks, doesn't he? But I spoke to him this morning. I also spoke to his coach, Paolo Slongo. They're looking forward to a different type of climb this week.
He's still only a minute down, 17 or something down.
Yeah, I mean, the time trial will obviously be a worry. I think they're probably budgeting for a 2-minute loss to Froome over 40 kilometres of time trialing. But there are a few opportunities. Even tomorrow, perhaps the descent off the Velafique climb before Cal Alto is not really the most opportune moment to launch an attack. But there will be opportunities, I'm sure. His team is not particularly strong. I mean, Pellizzotti rode well today, but I think they're quite brittle. And as we've mentioned before on the podcast, I think Nibali himself is a bit frustrated with the lack of resources they've had this year. But he does have incredible pedigree. We talked about sort of company he keeps now in the history of cycling, and various achievements that Nibali's notched up, which have only been equaled by four or five or six other riders. So, you know, he's a guy who over 3 weeks you can never really count out.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Rafa is the Rafa website, rafa.cc, is a great place not only to buy fantastic clothing, including, of course, the Cycling Podcast range of Pedlar de Charme clothing, but some really good stuff to read and watch there. And a story that caught my eye today, Rhys Radio, former Rafa employee who we know well, Rhys Howell's now riding as a pro for Team Wiggins. There's a great sort of diary there of his exploits recently to ride two races in two countries in 24 hours. He rode the Rafa Nocturne in Copenhagen and got back with very little sleep to ride a race in the UK the following day.
That reminds me of something I think I wrote in a... This sounds like a, not even a humble brag, an immodest brag. I wrote a book about Eddie Merckx. And one year where I recapped all the criteriums that he'd done after the tour. And there was one day where he rode in Sauciac, which is in the very southwest of France, I think in the morning. And then in the evening, he rode somewhere way up in the north of France. And it was also the day that when Crosby, Stills and Nash were playing in Woodstock. So what year would that be? 1968. 69 or 68? Anyway, sorry, Richard. Sorry, Richard.
It's good. Was it fueled by brandy as well, was it, by any chance?
Possibly.
You know, actually, about short, quick trips, I can tell you that there was a bullfighter in the 70s, 80s in Spain, El Cordobés, that used to have a little plane in order to travel from one arena to another and and perform in two different bullfighting shows in the same evening.
You would need a small plane for some of the transfers on this Vuelta. I would quite like to be traveling a small plane.
I think we need to get the Rafa helicopter for next year for covering the Vuelta. The route is, Bob Jungels made a comment about it on Twitter today. The route is ridiculous. We're just zigzagging our way around
the
country.
It's deceptive, isn't it? You can look at it from a distance, from afar, and you can look at these little pockets of stages, three or four stages, one off the other, and they look as though they're all in the same part of Spain. You think, that's oh, great, we're going to be settled then. But oh, no.
Yeah, but, you know, even if that's a fair claim, I think that the course has actually been quite entertaining. I mean, of course, the route has been ridiculous from the point of view of traveling, but the course has been entertaining
It has. And the leader, as we speak, is, of course, Chris Froome. I mentioned earlier that I went to see him yesterday in the Team Sky hub.
Fist bump?
Well, I was actually I just cleaned my hands, but there was no shake.
High five?
He tried to do a fist bump.
Big tens.
here's Chris Froome. Chris, we're in. I don't know what we call it. What do we call this new construction? The hub.
The hub.
Well, what's this been like at the Vuelta?
It's been pretty cool having what we call the Sky Hub here on the Vuelta. I mean, not a massive change for us riders because we previously had the kitchen truck where we could all eat together and that was our little space. But on here, riders are downstairs. We've got our little sort of corner down there. But I think more importantly, this is the whole upper section here with two long tables for staff. It means there's always hot food for the mechanics who finish late, the soigneurs who finish late sometimes, finish massage, washing everything, preparing bottles for the next day, finish them sometimes at midnight, and there's always a warm meal because most places would probably close most hotels would close the restaurants around 10, 11 o'clock. So it's a place where people to congregate really and grab a coffee during the day and I think in terms of communication and just bringing people together it's a great step forward.
Now we're speaking just after you won yesterday's stage and you're in a pretty commanding lead at the moment, or so it looks. But to win a stage, that's not something you've done this year, crossing the line first with your arms in the air. Was it something that bothered you at all? And is there an element of relief?
I mean, it wasn't something that bothered me, but sure, I mean, it's something as a bike rider, that's the ultimate joy, to cross the line first and put your arms in the air. And as you said, I haven't done that yet this year. And it's been a fantastic season for me, winning the tour. I mean, that was my big goal. I had set everything on that. But yeah, I hadn't put my arms in the air, and yesterday certainly it did feel good to do that.
How do you feel your form is here compared to the tour?
I think it's good, better than I expected. I mean, I've always previously come to the Vuelta and just been hanging on basically to what I've had, but I think just the way we've structured the season this year, coming into the tour maybe a little bit underdone, a little bit fresher. I hadn't done many race days building up to the tour. Probably meant I probably wasn't quite as sharp as I normally would be at the tour. But having done 3,500 Ks at the tour, done another 2,000 Ks to 2,500 Ks after the tour, I think it's just given me that extra base, if you like, to come to the Vuelta, and I am feeling better on the bike.
And you mentioned an altitude camp between the Tour and the Vuelta. Was that Tenerife? Or
No. So that was over in the Alps.
So close to home, really.
Yeah, not far from the south of France, up in Isola 2000.
And I guess one of the questions is, you know, no one's done the Tour Vuelta double since the Vuelta moved. And one reason for that is because riders win the Tour and feel that that's enough. They don't need to win the Vuelta. And the question is, why do you appear to so desire a win at the Vuelta?
I think just because I'm a bike racer, I guess. I mean, the Vuelta is a cool race. It's a race for me that I've always enjoyed coming here. It was the first race for me back in 2011 where I sort of discovered that I was able to ride at the sharp end of mountaintop finishes and subsequently time trials as well, and be able to put that all together into 3 weeks. So I've always had good memories at the Vuelta, even though I'd never won it. It's a race that I really enjoy doing. The Spanish public are fantastic. They get behind all the riders, and it's just a good atmosphere. And I think if you're motivated towards the second end of the season, it's a race that you can do well in.
If you did win it, would you imagine you'd come back and try and win it again, or would you feel that was that box ticked?
I think I'd have to get there. I'd have to get there and make that decision once I'm in that position. I mean, as I said, it is a race I enjoy doing. So, I could come and do the Tour of Britain instead. I mean, I don't get much racing in the UK. I'd love to come and do that. But having said that, Britain doesn't really suit me. The Vuelta is much more suited to my riding style. Just savage mountaintop finishes. 40 degree temperatures. It is right up my alley, the Vuelta.
And we are, I mean, I say you're in a commanding lead. It's still just seconds, and we are still quite early into the race. What do you see as the biggest threats over the next couple of weeks?
I think, obviously, I'm very conscious of how I lost the Vuelta last year, given that stage to Formigal, where I probably lost, what was it, 2.5-3 minutes to Alberto Contador and Nairo Quintana. A bit of an ambush attack at the beginning of the stage. So I'm very conscious of anything like that happening again. And in all the starts, I'm putting in more of an effort to be right up front and make sure that I'm aware of everything that's going up the road. Esteban Chavez has been climbing fantastically. I'd say from the GC group, he's probably the next strongest climber. He's been up there on a couple of occasions and looking strong. And I imagine he's also, having done the Tour, it looks as if to me he's building into this race, and I imagine he'll get stronger as the race goes on.
Your trademark, Chris, when you first won the Tour 2013, again in 2015, was a attacking, dropping everybody, and winning alone. That's not something you've done. I'm not going to say you've not been able to do, but you've not done it the 2016, 2017. Are your climbing powers waning a bit, or is it the others have caught up?
I think there's a few different elements to that. I think the general level of the field is moving on, definitely moving on. Interesting just to see power numbers and everything, and I think certainly from 2 years ago, same climb, yesterday for example, same climb 2 years ago, things have moved on from then. The powers I was doing 2 years ago, there were 20 guys doing that power yesterday, and that time up that climb. So the sport is evolving, the sport is moving forward, and I believe the level of competition, especially in the climbs, is moving on.
You've also changed the way that you race. We saw that particularly last year. Is that something you consciously have tried to do and thought about, or is it just happened in the moment?
I think it's just been a bit of an evolution. I think I'm certainly maturing over the years. I'm learning to read races differently, whereas I think previously I'd be feeling good. You just put me on a climb and off I'd go. Whereas now I'm actually thinking about what I'm doing a lot more. I think I try and time things better, time my attacks better.
But you know, a lot of people make a lot of the improvement you made as a GC rider, as a climber. Perhaps the improvement as descenders is just as dramatic. People don't talk about that so much.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd like to agree with you there. I do believe I've looked at other aspects of the race and identified how I can win in other ways.
Chris, another aspect that comes with success is the attention that you get now. I remember you in pole last year. You were riding to the start. You're like the Pied Piper, people chasing you. You've got a bodyguard here. Do you deal with all that? And has it changed you? Has success changed you at all?
I'd like to think it hasn't changed me as a person. Still go home at the end of the day, and all my mates from school we're all just the same together. But certainly it feels as if my environment at the races and obviously in the public domain, that has changed. I do get stopped a lot when I go out. And coming to a race like the Tour de France or the Vuelta a España, it becomes very difficult just to get from the bus to sign on, unless I've got that help from a bodyguard or someone to a chaperone to sort of move people out of the way, because it does get pretty full on at times. So certainly things have changed for me, but it's part of the job. It does come with the territory of having won the Tour now 4 times and being at the top of the sport for six, seven years now.
Do you enjoy it? Do you enjoy that aspect of it?
I mean, I enjoy the happiness it gives people. I mean, just something simple like stopping to sign a jersey for a kid or something. I mean, it's pretty cool to be able to give someone that happiness, that joy. But there are times when it does get pretty full on, and when it's been a tough day on the bike, and you just want to get somewhere, and you've got 10 people in your way hugging you for selfies, and it just sometimes it does get a bit much. But most of the time, I mean, I do obviously appreciate all the sport and appreciate that people do look up to me now and realize that I've got a responsibility to a lot of people as well.
So that was Chris Froome hinting that he'll ride the Tour of Britain next year. I neglected to ask him whether the Giro might figure, but I think he will ride the Giro at some point. I don't think next year, because going for 5 Tour de France wins is not something you really want to compromise. But I think you mentioned, Fran, that the Nairo Quintana, of course, famously went for the Giro Tour double this year and failed. The thing that you think, or Movistar think, might have actually really counted against him was not the Giro, but the Vuelta as well, winning the Vuelta the previous year. So doing 3 Grand Tours in a 11-month period.
Exactly. He did 4 Grand Tours in barely 12 months, because after all, he did the Tour and the Vuelta in 2016 and the Giro and the Tour in 2017. That's quite a huge load of work for a body.
Yeah, and there is a school of thought that a block of work like that can have long-term damaging effects on a rider. I mean, if you speak to, for example, our chum Dan Lloyd, who now works for GCN, and I'm sure everyone knows, there was one year when he did the Giro, the Dauphiné, and the Tour, and he is quite convinced that he was never the same athlete. Never, his body had changed irrevocably after that, and he never really recovered.
On that cheery note,
how are we going to recover, Fran? How are we going to recover tonight? How are we going to recharge our batteries? I'm thinking about food. Murcian food. We talked about Murcia earlier. I had goat last night. It was very good, which is quite typical of Murcia, I think.
Yes. What should
and we're on? We're staying in a place which has some lovely fig trees.
It's a hacienda.
Yeah, really strong aromas of figs all about the place. What should we look out for tonight?
Well, if you are into cholesterol, if you are into cholesterol, you can go and ask for meat pie. This is a typical food from
What's
this
the name
part
in Murcia?
Pastel de carne.
Okay.
And it's a mix up of every piece of meat available and even some boiled eggs.
I hope Lionel's not listening to this. He'll be literally dribbling at the, yeah. at the thought of that.
You know, I am relaxed because I know that I'm going to give Lionel the treat of his life in Asturias when I introduce him to the wonders of cachopo.
Now listen, before we go, we've got an interesting stage tomorrow. You mentioned earlier, you spoke to Igor Anton at the start this morning because he won here in 2006.
Exactly. That was the second time that this climb was ridden. The first one was in 2004. And if you look at the standings of that day, it's like a horror show because you have on the top placings Roberto Heras, Santi Pérez, Aitor González, Isidro Nozal, you know, quite an interesting freak show.
A hall of, if you a hall ask of infamy.
And yeah. I think, did they go over the Alto de Velefic before that, Fran, on that stage? Yeah. I was just going to say that if you are watching on TV tomorrow, I'm sure you'll enjoy the helicopter shots of that climb. It has been dubbed the sort of Alpe d'Huez of Spain. Lots and lots of hairpins, a bit of a sort of spaghetti type road that goes up to that climb. Fantastic visual climb.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the Vuelta had a summit finish there in 2009. Right, the Rider Estrella won before of in front of David García da Pena, another freak of the Spanish cycling. And in 2006, it was Igor Anton, the one to win here. He actually says in the interview, as you want to hear, that it was one of the most beautiful victories of his career.
Let's hear him now then.
Tell me, what did you expect of tomorrow's stage? How would you describe that Calar Alto climb?
Bueno, first I would like to pass today. Not easy day with raining, but yeah, tomorrow is really incredible. Remember, there are 11 years ago, and yes, it's amazing. My first victory, not the best, but in the big races. Yeah. And well, the return is amazing after a lot of years. No, it's, and I would like to stay strong tomorrow.
Yeah. How is the Vuelta going for you so far?
Good, good. The feeling's really good, but not possible attack or. Because the rhythm is amazing. We go every day is fast. And yes, I feel good. The legs, the head, and well, day by day I am fighting for the general, for the GC.
Yeah.
But it's not easy. I would like to pass more forward.
Yeah, to attack more, right?
Yeah.
Sam's Igor Anton, the Dimension Data leader, still writing for GC, as he told you. Before we wrap up, just a quick reminder that you can listen to Kilometer Zero. If you're a friend of the podcast, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Our third, fourth, fifth episode of Kilometer Zero is coming out Wednesday morning. And that is one with the photographers. It's really interesting and fun. We've spoken to a few of the photographers who cover the Grand Tours. The Grubers, Jared and Ashley. We've got Simon Gill, our own photographer, and James Start is in there as well. It's really good, really
big
interesting.
Hitters in there.
Oh yeah, it's quite funny as well, I think. Yesterday, Monday, on the rest day, we had Hayden Groves, who is riding the race one day ahead of the pros, as he did at the Giro and the Tour. Really interesting story about food as well, because he's producing a cookbook. He is an award-winning chef. So hope you enjoyed that. And as I say, become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, we're off to eat figs.
Goat.
And goat. Thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you very much, Val.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.